Welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. This podcast is brought to you in association with Game Refinery. Join us as we uncover the latest trends in mobile game design.
Hello and welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. Thanks for tuning in for another episode. This is the podcast that provides insights into what makes a great mobile game, what is and isn't working for mobile game designers, and all the latest trends. I'm your host, John Jordan. And joining me this week is Erno Kieske, Chief Analyst for the US at Game Refinery. How's it going, Erno?
It's going great. How are you doing, John?
Good, good. And we have Timu Palomaki from the Game Analyst at Japan Game Refinery. How's it going, Timu?
It's going great. Great to be here.
Good, good. And finally, we have, from Game Refinery at least, we have Kalle Halkinen, who's the Chief Game Analyst for the China region. How's it going?
Excellent. How are you, John?
Good, good, yes. So we have a full range of people from Game Refinery because we're going to be talking about something very specific, which is the Game Refinery Mobile Game Dev Awards. But we also have a kind of a expert guest with us as well, who was actually a judge for the awards. Going to be covering the games that we're talking about as well. John Wright, Vice President of Operations at Lunar Labs. How's it going, John?
Hey, John. Yeah, glad to be here.
Good. Do you want to give us a bit of a view on what you do at Lunar Labs and what Lunar Labs does?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Vice President of Operations, as you said. Essentially, we are a creative technology platform that allows the mobile developers to produce playable and video ads directly from their Unity code. So we're a very different beast in the industry compared to the other players. Everything is done from the development angle and reusing the assets that have already been created within the games itself. And, my background is predominantly in user acquisition and monetization strategies within mobile gaming. And I've been working in the space now for about 7 or 8 years. Before that, I was actually an accountant and I hated my life. and so I decided to get out of finance and get into gaming, which is my true passion. So, yeah, that's where we are.
Good. That's it. We've already got a takeaway from the podcast. If you're an accountant who hates accounting, and you like games, go into games. Good.
Exactly.
Okay. So in this episode of the podcast, we are going to discuss Game Refinery's new annual awards, which are the Mobile Game Dev Awards. And they're specifically kind of been created to reward design and innovation in the mobile games industry and obviously kind of tie into the sort of data and intelligence that Game Refinery provides for developers. So there's six categories, which I'll read out. We're not going to discuss all of them, but they're pretty interesting categories, I think. I quite like them. So the first one is innovation in core gameplay. And then we have most promising soft launch game. Then biggest evolver, best newcomer, and best innovation and best event. So that's kind of what the awards are covering. And many of those awards are broken down into different regions, which is why we have our US, Japan, and our China experts to discuss particularly what's going on in those territories. But the first one we're going to discuss is innovation and excellence in core gameplay. And there's just one winner there. I guess you're going to have one winner with that sort of a category title. And that is Genshin Impact, a game we have discussed a lot over the last year, it seems. Who's going to kick us off and talk? I guess a bit of an introduction for people who haven't come across Genshin Impact before. Who can do that for us?
Yeah, I can pick that up. So like you mentioned, Genshin Impact, probably one of the most talked about games during the last year, and no wonder why, because that's the reason why we also picked it up as our award winner in this case. So Genshin Impact, basically it's a single player mainly open world RPG, and also very notable, it's a crossplay title, so you can play it on your mobile phone with PC or even your PlayStation and so on. But yeah, what makes the game so special then? And why we actually chose it in this category? Well, if we look at Genshin Impact, especially I'm coming from the Western market analyst point of view, and for longest period of time, action RPGs on mobile haven't been really doing well on the Western markets. And a lot of the players have been feeling that the core gameplay, it's you're just automating the core gameplay and you're playing those games because of the meta side and because of the progression loops, and you enjoy the kind of like getting stronger and stronger and that kind of aspects of the gameplay. But the actual core gameplay has been a little bit on the sidelines on the mobile games, and that hasn't really resonated super strongly on the Western markets, especially. And if we think about Genshin, what it actually does differently, summarize Genshin? I think it's kind of like a best of both worlds from console and mobile. So if we look at the core gameplay, it is actually a mobile game that can be played on mobile with a core gameplay that is totally kind of like comparable with your premium AAA console titles. And then the other side of the coin is the best elements that we have seen on the mobile, which is the long-term progression and those meta mechanics and then, of course, the free-to-play monetization and stuff like that. So in a nutshell, I think Genshin is kind of like combining those two things. And if you look at the core gameplay, it's super fluid gameplay, feels really, 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 really nice to play. Of course, they have the element system that it's basically in the center of everything. So you're playing around with the elements in the combat, combining those elements and trying to find synergies with those. And then you have your open world in a single player action RPG, which brings a totally different type of immersion to the core gameplay when you're actually moving around into the world and getting immersed to the game. And then you have your puzzles in the exploration part of the open world and stuff like that. So those are kind of like the couple key points in a nutshell why we think the Genshin Impact is so remarkable achievement from Miojo.
Good. John, how do you see Genshin?
Yeah, so from my personal perspective and also professional perspective, it's hands down the best title release on mobile over the last year. There's a couple of aspects that I think, you know, we should touch on here. One is the fact that, you know, Erno was completely correct in the sense that this is a AAA experience coming to a mobile first user. There is no need for an auto battle function because the users are actually in depthly playing it and experiencing it and playing it in the same way they would actually from a console experience, which is something that's very, very, very rare. The fact is a lot of mobile games in the same vein focus very much on the meta and the fact this, you know, grinding elements and being able to level up your characters and get new characters and stronger characters, which this game has sort of superseded that, giving that AAA experience. The other thing for me is the fact is the monetization strategy. So Genshin was a $100 million investment. This is for a non-IP coming from, you know, a studio that has not had, I'd say, as big as projects previously. And to invest $100 million in production before even turning over a dollar is a very, very brave move. However, it ended up being extremely profitable for them, and they made about $500 million within the first 2 months. And actually, the monetization strategy they have here is something that's quite, I wouldn't say completely foreign to the Western market, but it's much more suited to the East, which is the gacha monetization strategy, which essentially is paying to unlock certain characters through like a luck-based system. So we would see this as a, you know, a sort of more like a loot box, which we know has had some controversy in the recent times. However, I think, the design is beautiful. The monetization is super strong. The gameplay is fantastic. You know, for me, I can't wait for it to come out on Switch. And I get very big sort of Breath of the Wild, Zelda vibes, which is one of the main influences between the development. But all in all, again, probably my favourite title of the last 12 months.
It's a good point there, your last point. It does seem very much like kind of Switch with its kind of portability is kind of becoming it is a mobile, it's a portable console. So, but what I'm trying to say is it's becoming like almost like a stepping stone between mobile and what we might call the bigger sort of home consoles. I guess we just had Zynga just announced they're doing a mobile game also on Switch, but we won't go into that. That'll be another podcast. Kalle, I mean, obviously your expertise is the China market. So how's Genshin been taken up in China?
Yeah, it has found its success in multiple different markets, not only in the US. So it has been a stable top 10 crossing game in there as well. I think one thing that's really interesting that just caught my eye in was it 2 or 3 days ago was that there was this interview on the president of MiHoYo, and he said that their plan is to create a 1 billion person MMO RPG in 10 years. So their plan is to launch new games every, 3 years or so. And the end goal is that after 10 years, they will have this huge MMO experience. So I think that was quite interesting. Also, one other point, you mentioned that the cost was 100 million to make. And in that same article, they mentioned that it also costs 200 million per year to do the live ops for that game. So that's quite interesting as well. So
it sounds like he doesn't lack ambition.
Yeah.
Gracious, yes. So we should say that's the name of the Chinese developer's name. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. MiHoYo is the Chinese developer. Timu, has it been such a big hit in Japan?
It has found success there as well. So Japanese people are used to gacha games. They like their anime, and I think those are fairly present in Genshin Impact. So, yeah, it's doing well there as well. So, all around success.
Yes, yeah. We can. Success, global success. I don't think anyone would argue with Genshin Impact as being the game to win innovation and excellence in core gameplay. I think we've covered that one off pretty well. An interesting one, I guess, that we don't often see a lot of awards around kind of things like kind of, I suppose it was best improved. Maybe that's the sports equivalent is the kind of most improved player. So it's not exactly the same for our best evolver. So the best evolver is defined as the game that has developed the most during 2020 in terms of gameplay. And these are, we've split these out. So there's one per kind of region. And we'll start with the US. So I guess this will be one for you, Erno, to go for. So Marvel Strike Force is the winner there, and it's been out now for a number of years. So why do we think this has kind of taken off or kind of revitalized in 2020?
Yeah, definitely. Of course, a lot of games are doing a lot of stuff, and it's always hard to pick one winner. But what we wanted to do, kind of like look more, is not just the performance necessarily, but also like the feature set and how the game has been actually evolving during that year. But actually Marvel Strike Force fits both of those terms. So of course the big thing from the start of the year was the acquisition of Foxnext. So Scopely acquired Foxnext, which naturally gives access for the game to get access to the Scopely's muscle in live ops and UA and stuff like that. And as we can see from the charts and see from the rankings, they definitely doubled down on their UA, and they also rised in the crossing rankings because of that. But also, on top of that, they did a bunch of things on the product side. So during that last year, they actually implemented, firstly, a synchronous PvP mode, which is actually an interesting implementation in a turn-based RPG. It's not that common. We have seen some games that use this kind of feature in a turn-based RPG setting, but now Strikeforce added it into the game. They started by adding it as a kind of like a test feature with kind of like a possibility to play against your friends or guildmates and so on. But later on during the year, they went on full on with the kind of like its separate PvP mode called Real-Time Arena, where you're playing these real-time synchronous battles. And that game mode is monetized with a battle pass. So each season you get a battle pass with a specific focus on specific characters, and you have your basic task-based progression, and then you're getting further and further and acquiring tons of different rewards by playing that game mode. One thing to note is that they Scopely is definitely still working on this feature. It's still relatively new, so there is no kind of like, for example, rankings for the real-time arena or stuff like that. So it's going to be interesting to see where they take the feature in, for example, this year. And then the second really big addition that they did during the year was the ISO 8 system. So as we know, in all kind of RPGs, there are a lot of upgrading layers and there are a lot of things that you can do with your character and stuff like that. But actually, quite a few games have this kind of like a customization. Usually the like the upgrading, it's kind of linear and you have this specific things that you can do and so on and so on. Of course, some games bring customization, like for example Genshin with their equipment items and so on. But this ISO 8 system that they added is basically similar to that. So you collect these ISO 8 items and then you can select which kind of specific traits and specific passive skills you want to unlock for each character. So then as you have your team of five characters and so on, then let's say I want this character to have a little bit more like health, for example, by adding a specific ISO 8 item to that character. And then this next one, let's say I want it to be doing a little bit more damage and so on. So this brings this another addition of kind of like a customization, a little bit more strategy. And then, of course, that even combined with the real-time arena, then it brings these interesting possibilities for players to play around and think about what to do.
Yeah, I should point out for people who maybe kind of aren't aware of everything going on in mobile games. So the game developer for Marvel Strike Force was Fox Next, was part of the Fox kind of a company structure. And then another mobile games company called Scopely, pretty well known, quite aggressively expanding at the moment, bought Marvel Strike Force, or bought Foxnet, and so acquired Marvel Strike Force. So I guess what you're saying there is it kind of wins the prize because it had had a whole bunch of features that were already kind of in development and launched, but also it was kind of boosted by the fact that the acquisition by Scopely seems to have kind of fired up the sort of business side of things and the marketing side, and those two things kind of combined quite nicely to really kind of boost up a game that's always I've kind of not played it for a while, but it always felt like a very high quality game that never quite had reached its kind of market fit. You know, it seemed odd for a Marvel game with all those great Marvel characters, and it never really it done sort of middling, but you always kind of felt there was that, you know, it could do better. So I guess that's kind of what's happening now. John, have you played a lot of Marvel Strike Force?
Yeah, so for me, I completely agree with a lot of statements. I think the ISO 8 system really made a much deeper gaming experience, especially from the PvP aspects. So the fact you can actually customize like different equipments, equip them to different characters in different ways that yield different results. When combining this with PvP, it results in obviously the ability to get one up on your opponent with the right selection of equipment and the right strategy. It gives the game a lot more depth. I think the two other interesting things for me is obviously, you know, because it's part of the Marvel universe and it lends itself to the IP very, very well. So there's, I think, 200 plus characters that you can unlock within the game itself. So, you know, if you're a collector persona in terms of the way that you play games, you like collecting things, then, you know, this game can give you hundreds of hours of enjoyment by going through that experience and using the daily achievements to unlock different characters and your favorite Marvel heroes. They also, for me, with the launch of the Dark Dimension feature, which, to be completely honest, I haven't even been able to unlock personally because you have to be level 65. So what they've done here very well, Scopely, I feel like, because it's an older game, they've lent it to the players who previously felt unchallenged because they had, you know, played the game a lot when it first came out or in the first couple of years. Now they're launching, you know, new features which lend itself for the more experienced and hardcore player to keep them from being bought. So I think that's, you know, that sets for the longevity of player usage and retention. And I think it's a very, very, very cool system, especially with the real-time arena, as Erno said, which again brings another aspect to the game and brings people coming back, playing with their friends, and increasing engagement.
Good, excellent. So Marvel Strike Force, the winner in the kind of US kind of region. Let's move on to Japan. So Timo, this will be one for you. And the winner of the game that evolved the most in 2020 is Pokemon Go. I guess that probably Pokemon Go did well kind of everywhere, but I guess particularly as a kind of the Japanese and Pokemon Go well together. Can you explain a bit about how what they did to kind of win that award?
Yeah, well, we had this year 2020 that everyone will surely remember for a long time. I don't know. There was this small thing called COVID-19 pandemic. And considering Pokemon Go is kind of a game that depends on you moving around in different locations and maybe doing raids together with some people in like populated spots, that the game would have severe challenges on such a year. So, well, that turned out not to be the case. And, well, the game was able to adapt to the situation. They might have had some of these features planned even beforehand a little bit, but they were able to bring some stuff that helped people really enjoy the game safely from home with remote raid passes and well, with those you could well, for example, I was able to help my brother who lives in a different city. When they were participating in a raid, they didn't have enough people. He sent me an invite. I was able to join there. So it added kind of a distant social element in a way. And overall, they were just doing really, really great and making sure that people could enjoy the game safely. And they had I think it was a record year for them, which is well done during a pandemic.
No, it must be very interesting to have a global situation happen that basically totally upends your sort of entire business model. I mean, the one thing people like about Pokemon Go is it gets people outside and wandering around trying to find these different real world locations. I mean, it is the one successful location based game that we have. Lots of people have tried. Only Pokemon Go has worked. And then suddenly for people basically to not be able to leave their house is a pretty fundamental change. So I guess to some degree, some of the features they put in to allow people to play in, you know, within their homes, they must have been thinking about that beforehand, because I just can't think you could engineer stuff that quickly. But I guess a lot of it was kind of speeded up and was kind of fairly important for them on the business side to kind of get in. And it's kind of interesting because the whole idea, the team behind Pokemon Go, are very much about getting people outside, and they have these kind of wellness sort of ideals kind of baked into what they're trying to do as a company at a very deep level. So that must have been kind of hard for them to do that. But I guess it's interesting that maybe the other kind of reaction to it was people, people who play Pokemon Go love it. And they, I guess they kind of really enjoyed the fact that this game had changed dramatically. But that kind of, I guess, gave them some sense of kind of agency and urgency, in they could still play their favorite game. And that game was reacting to the situation. And I guess that, those kind of things, obviously games in general, have been important for people who feel socially limited otherwise in 2020. John, have you been playing Pokemon Go during various lockdowns?
Yeah, so look, I'm in my early 30s. So I'm of the generation where Pokemon was a huge part of my life. I do have a shiny Charizard in collection somewhere. So for me, I couldn't agree more. I think the agility of Niantic and the way that they actually responded to COVID was just phenomenal. The ability to create, local gyms in around your house or make it in your house when you got to a certain level was a great addition to, which allowed people to engage and do stuff without having to go outside. I think the remote passes that allowed you to do gym battles in off-site locations with your friends brought a lot of people back. This is including me. Me and my friends came back after about a hiatus, about a year or two. So because we were able to use remote passes. And also the fact that they monetized these through IAP was amazing, because we spent a bunch more money than we ever would have previously. The fact that Team Rocket started to actually have the balloon and turn up to where you were rather than where you were going also gave this sort of battle element to the overall experience, which as the original protagonists of the actual storyline, it was very fun to put that back. And also I think they experienced something new with some of the events that they put in together with, like, for example, the brand event with Gucci. So for me, this was something that, you know, a lot of people have been talking about for a long time, is about getting, you know, brand dollars within the mobile gaming ecosystem. And Gucci, which are a high-end fashion label, actually paid Niantic, you know, or Pokemon Company, you know, millions of dollars for the ability to have their clothing label as on the avatars. Which is something that we've seen maybe once or twice with other brands, but you know, we saw like the NFL takeover of Rovio with Angry Birds, and Gucci actually did another one with Tennis Clash. But it's something that, you know, a lot of agencies and brand bucks are not being spent because of COVID. You know, all this money was taken back by these big advertisers, and to see that money invested in mobile gaming, I think is just amazing for our ecosystem. And it's widening in the eyes of people that mobile gaming is not just for 15-year-old kids in their basement. So it's a very good thing for me.
Excellent. Okay, so the final game we're going to look at in the biggest developer category is from China, or in the Chinese kind of region, and that's Crossfire. And so that's one for Kelle.
Yes, so I think it's best if I just give some context on the game, because there might be some people in the audience who are not that familiar with Crossfire. So I think in the West, if we would be listing out iconic shooter games, we would probably be throwing out names like Counter-Strike or Overwatch or Fortnite. But in China, that list would definitely include Crossfire as well. It's a game that was originally released for PC back in 2007. But in 2015, it found its way into mobile as well. Smilegate, so the developer itself, says that the game has 8 million concurrent players and 650 million all-time registered players. So this is for the franchise as a whole, not only for the mobile version. But I think it gives you a nice indication of what kind of a franchise we're talking about. And the mobile version that we have in China was developed and published together with Tencent. It was an instant top-grossing hit from the get-go. And it's pretty much been a top 50 grossing game ever since. But now, in 2020, that was an excellent year for this shooter. It included some really interesting and excellent updates, new content, which all resulted in an outstanding financial performance for the game. So it's now basically a top 20 grossing stable. And the game also gained boost from the Crossfire TV series that was premiered in the summer last year. Now, product-wise, as I mentioned, it had a couple of really interesting game modes that were introduced via the updates. I'm not going to go too deep into this, but to just give you a general idea, one of these was a mode that sort of mashed up interactive story, narrative elements and character relationship building elements with the shooter gameplay, which I think was really interesting. And then there was another one that combined these. It was a co-op PvE mode that had these elements from the Archero playbook. So you went through these levels, and after levels, if you were successful, you could choose different kind of boosts for yourself. Now, Call of Duty Mobile is a game that was introduced to China just a couple of months ago. So there are now three top shooters in China. So Call of Duty Mobile, Game for Peace, which is the PUBG in China, and then Crossfire. And when Call of Duty Mobile was launched, it was interesting to see that it really didn't affect the market share of Crossfire, but it was more about taking market share away from Game for Peace, actually. So I think that also talks about the defensibility of the Crossfire brand as well. So all in all, the Crossfire brand is really strong in China. It has a strong fan base. The feature set is very competitive, and it's been just rolling out excellent updates constantly. So I think the future looks very bright for this game as well.
I mean, I guess it kind of comes as part of, if you have a category called Biggest Evolver, those are not going to be games that have probably just been released. But it is interesting that these games, they have been around now. You know, I mean, Crossfire, you know, has been around in various forms for over a decade now. But it is interesting how developers can keep these games kind of refreshed. And it's interesting, you know, you said, John, that they, you know, you bought back into Pokemon Go. So I guess we've all had these games that we've, you know, dabbled with or played quite a lot. I played kind of Marvel Strike Force, you know, quite a lot when it was first released, and at some point you kind of churn out. But because they have these massive audiences, if they can do something that catches our attention, we can get drawn back in again. It is interesting that I think kind of mobile games in particular do that well with the kind of the live ops stuff that maybe that's something other kind of game designers and other game operators can kind of learn from. So anyway, so that's Biggest Evolver. Let's move on to again something else that mobile has done particularly well, which is Best Event, which is sort of in game event. We're going to look at two games here. One we've already discussed. So the US winner here was Genshin Impact. And I think the event was called Unreconciled Stars. Erno, do you want to give us a bit of a lowdown on what that was?
Yeah. So again, there are a lot of the similarities that we already talked about goes into this selection. So, well, if we think about live ops, overall in the mobile game scene, of course, it's one of the biggest things and one of the most important things, like we have seen with the Biggest Evolver category and so on. But thinking about events, many of the games, of course, they use the kind of they have their, for example, seasonal event format, and they use the same mechanics and they roll around that with a different type of team and so on. But again, what really impressed me personally, for example, with Genshin Impact was also how much effort, how much ambition they also put into their live events and the live ops stuff. So this case, this event that we chose was the first event that came into the game. And what actually makes the event so amazing in terms of production value is that if you look at the event, basically it's this kind of a three-layered world event where something happens in the world and then you are completing these quests and stuff like that. But on top of that, we have a totally a new storyline, that everything is voice acted, all the similar production quality cutscenes, stuff like that, that we are used to when we played the main story, for example, with Genshin Impact. Now it's just the event story, with the cutscenes and stuff like that. And then on top of that, always now, I think the game has had the three of these kind of big events where, and then all the new characters that they are introducing to the game, that comes kind of a part of the event story usually, and that is the way to introduce the players to the characters then that they monetize with the new gachas and new banner gachas that they are offering and so on. So definitely the biggest impression and kind of the reason behind this choice was kind of similar as with the choice for the core gameplay and so on. It's the effort that MiHoYo has clearly put into these events and the level of quality that kind of oozes from the events and so on. And this same trend is going on. Like I said, now three events they have released, and the latest event was actually even bigger than this one, but it was during this year, during the Lunar New Year, they had this event with the separate a tower defense game mode and stuff like that, but let's not go into that one.
Well, one for next year maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
So John, how have you felt the kind of the your kind of playing of the game has been affected by these? I mean, it sounds like these sort of games within games sort of thing going on.
Yeah, I think if we look at this from purely a user retention and engagement perspective, they work, right? Like the ability to give unique content for a limited time period to re-engage with an audience is extremely powerful. I think the way that they market these is also very strong, and the fact that people can sign up in a limited time period and have this unique experience and then also get the reward of some sort of unique item or items as part of that is something that's very, very cool. And I think it's a tried and tested model. I think Genshin have adopted it very well. However, I do think there is more left in the tank for them, and I'm sure they've got some exciting stuff on the roadmap for this year.
And the final game we're going to look at is in again the best event, and this time for Japan. And I guess the kind of the Japanese developers are kind of the kind of prime movers really of this sort of in-game event, and really keeping their audience engaged. And the winner here is Deep Breath, Final Fantasy Brave Exvius War of the Visions. So I guess that's going to be one for you, Timu, to unpick that event. And I think the event was a collaboration with Final Fantasy Tactics.
Yeah, so the Japanese version of the game had Final Fantasy Tactics event, collaboration event. First of all, collaboration events are very popular in Japan. You see them a lot, and this one was really nice. The game itself, if for those that don't know, it's kind of a strategic RPG. And so grid based, you have characters there fighting, kind of, well, reminds a bit of chess maybe, but similar to the Final Fantasy Tactics, maybe Langrisser, and maybe a little bit Advanced Wars, Fire Emblem, those kinds of games that used to be maybe more popular in 90s. There's one Alchemist, the Alchemist Code is on mobile, that is really similar to this. But and this is a sequel to Final Fantasy Brave Exvius, which has different mechanics, but it's also a mobile game. So that was interesting. But the reason this was able to do kind of a collaboration event is because it has its own characters, whereas, say, Final Fantasy Record Keeper or many of the Final Fantasy mobile games tend to have like all the Final Fantasy characters there and you collect them. But this one has its own unique story. So bringing over existing Final Fantasy characters has really impact there. So for this event specifically, Tactics Collaboration, it was a rerun that we wanted to focus on. They had done that same event earlier. It had resonated well. There were some really cool characters that people liked, and those characters were still quite relevant when the event ran again. So people knew those characters were cool. They liked them. They were quite meta, so everyone was using them. So they knew they had to get them. And at the same time, they also brought in new content, new characters from the game. So people had more to collect. And what really, I think what made the event also work is the excellent brand synergy it had. Of course, there's the obvious Final Fantasy, but also the collaboration Source game had very similar kind of gameplay mechanics. So it resonated well with the audience of this game. The art style is basically same. So it has a lot more impact than just throwing in maybe some other, well, Final Fantasy or some other similar RPG game there. So thinking about brand synergy is really important. And the event performed well. It was a good example of how to do a collaboration event properly.
Yeah, I guess with those sort of things, you have to be, has to be sort of similar enough that the audience kind of understands why the collaboration is happening, but different enough that it's different to what the kind of game is. So it's a bit of a balancing act there. You can't just have something really wacky because it doesn't appeal to your existing audience. I guess the one thing with Final Fantasy, there's just now such an enormous, probably, you know, 30 years of back history and, you know, thousands of different characters. There's plenty of potential. It's just kind of working out which ones work. And I guess, as you say, that if you have two slightly different sort of gameplay mechanics in there, that you can mesh those in and different characters works well. John, you are an expert in this field. How did you find this?
So I've personally sunk about 250 days into this, so like I should be able to give some insight here. But I think in terms of just to focus on the event itself, I think everything that was said was completely correct. I think the fact that there was the ability to unlock different characters, and there was also, you know, there's daily challenges and event challenges that allow you to get, you know, more crystals that allow you to unlock, you know, that sort of like and level up the, and awaken is the term within the game itself, but like awaken the character. So, you know, you had like Ramza Beowulf, who's the main protagonist of War of the Lions was the like the UR, so the ultimate rare character, the one that everyone got. I did get him. I was very happy by this. There was another sort of two other characters, Gaff Garion, who's the again one of the protagonists, and another character that I didn't get, but another one of the protagonists from the series. But all in all, the way that they actually support the event. So obviously there's custom storylines in the Far Plane. So the Far Plane is like where you have your event-based levels and experiences, which was fantastic. So there's like a 10 level sort of based experience that goes through the story of War of the Lions, which if you've never played is one of the best it's the best tactics Final Fantasy game from the 90s. I was a massive fan of the original, and this is why I like this game, is because of that connection. And then obviously the unique characters, the unique weapons and everything that goes around the event, as well as the different challenges and stuff that you can do within the game, just all brought it all together. And I really liked the comment from Timu around the different characters, because as he said, with like Record Keeper and some of the other Final Fantasy series, it's all about using other characters from other other games. Whereas in this game, they actually made a completely new story. It's very much like a lot of the other sort of Final Fantasy games in theory, in terms of like a sort of a sword and slash ATB strategy sort of game. But the fact that there's all of these other new characters, including the story's own protagonist, which is Mont, his family, which are the royal family, and then obviously, all of the enemies and different characters that come into the story over, I think there's 11 chapters in the game, and each chapter has 3 scenes, and each scene has 10 levels. So, there's a tremendous amount of content. But from an events perspective, whenever these crossover events happen, they're extremely impactful. Everyone wants to get involved, and, the engagement and monetization sort of abilities of the game kick in and people spend more. So one thing I would say is if anyone from Square Enix is listening, we would like more events like this. They're a bit few and far between. But yes, it's a sensational game for me.
You want to dump more time and money into it.
That's exactly it.
Excellent. Good. Well, thanks to everyone for their expertise. We've gone into a lot of depth on a lot of games. So hopefully that's kind of brought out for people what makes what some of the the best mobile games of last year were, or what were some of the best kind of techniques and the best ways of kind of re-engaging kind of audiences. And give you some kind of techniques that maybe be useful, hopefully, in the games that you're working on. And this is what we do at the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. Every podcast, we're kind of going deep into a certain aspect of mobile games and trying to kind of unpick what's going on there and try and give you some useful data. So thanks very much to our experts from Game Refinery, Erno, Timo, and Calais.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good, thank you. Guys. And thanks very much to John. Thanks very much to John, our expert.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. It was a pleasure.
And obviously, thanks to you guys for listening. It's really, we hope this stuff is useful, and we hope you're gaining benefit from it. So every podcast, we are kind of delving into what's going on. You can get us through all your usual podcast subscription kind of platforms. So please do subscribe and give us a review, obviously, because you'd like to do that. You're a nice person. So thanks for listening, and come back next time to hear what's going on in the world of mobile games.